You're listening to continuing coverage of the Rust shooting trial against Alec Baldwin from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Now back to the courtroom.
All right. Defendant Alec Baldwin's motion in limine to preclude inadmissible cumulative expert testimony. Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. And if you'd like, I can also address the Montoya case that you said you'd like to revisit. No, if you'd like to do that first or later. Okay, you're welcome, Your Honor. Your Honor, we've moved to exclude cumulative experts and witnesses that the state has intended to call and put on their witness list. 44 fact witnesses, 13 expert witnesses. We have an 8-day trial, 5 or 6 days for the state, many of them duplicative for medical experts, multiple gun experts, multiple experts on multiple issues. And we're in this impossible situation, Judge, where we're a day and a half away from the start of this trial. And we have no idea the order of witnesses they intend to call, which of the witnesses they intend to call. It's severely challenging our ability to present a fair defense, to present and prepare for the witnesses that they intend to call. This is the time and past the time for the state to say, this is the case they intend to put on, these are the witnesses they intend to call, and give us some transparency into how this trial is going to be conducted, so that can be conducted in an orderly way with witnesses that we're prepared for and on notice of. Thank you, Your Honor.
I'm not quite sure how to respond to that. So, Brian Carpenter is a necessary witness. Kent Jorgensen is a necessary witness. Paul Jordan, I'm going to decide whether or not I think I can cut him. I can't make that decision at this moment. The Hagues are necessary witnesses. Pieta's a necessary witness. Ziegler's a necessary witness. Let me tell you why. Even though Mr. Baldwin told OSHA investigators there wasn't anything wrong with this gun, it worked fine, the problem with it was a live round, the defense is centered around the gun was modified, the gun didn't function properly, I've got how many video exhibits have I disclosed to the court? 40? The reason that you've got so many is because that's how I proved to you that the gun was working fine, is because they're filming him and the gun works fine. He cocks it, it stays cocked. He decocks it, it decocks the way it should. He fires it. It fires. So my witness list and my experts are designed to deal with their defense. And that's what I'm supposed to do. That's what I'm allowed to do. So if they don't want to hear from the Hagues and Ziegler and Mr. Pieta, who's coming all the way from Italy, then they can give up on the silly notion that the gun was modified and that it malfunctioned. But until they do that, there's nothing I can do. I did reach out to Mr. Spiro with a thought about whether or not we could stipulate to the testimony of Mr. Gillette. Mr. Spiro, understandably, was not able to give me a quick answer because it was something that he needed to discuss with his client. And because Mr. Gillette lives in Virginia and is the explosives expert for the FBI, I couldn't just sit on my hands. But hope springs eternal. If we can come to a stipulation with regard to Gillette's testimony, I can strike Gillette. We may not call Dr. Carrillo now that we've heard from them. Finally, let's talk about transparency, that they're not pursuing the she died because she wasn't properly intubated theory. So we're going to hold Dr. Carrillo in abeyance. And assuming that this issue is never raised, as Mr. Spiro has indicated that it will not be, then she will not be called. But we certainly reserve the right to handle that however we see fit. It's entirely possible that we are not calling Shannon Prince. We will have to call Geraldine Conway because of the defendant's obvious public defense that he didn't pull the trigger. And I don't believe that we're calling Mr. Primo. So that's the transparency that you get from me now.
Just briefly, Your Honor. We've got Jorgensen testifying about said safety. We have Carpenter testifying about said safety. We have other people testifying about said safety. They want Mr. Jordan to come and testify about said safety in Montana. We'll deal with that separately. When you look at this witness list, 44 fact witnesses, 13 experts, four medical experts testifying. When you heard Mr. Spiro say, we are not challenging the quality of the intubation or the cause of death, this is a witness list that is ballooned far beyond what's even remotely possible in a trial of this length. And so we're asking for, it's a good start of the transparency, appreciate what Ms. Morrissey said, but we need a whole lot more of that in order to put on a fair and efficient trial and to be properly prepared for the witnesses that they intend to call, or else we're going to have witnesses testifying over and over and over again about the same exact subject matter, which is exactly what we're allowed to move to exclude on the basis that it's cumulative and it wastes time.
Thank you.
All right.
First of all, I have not looked at the witness lists, so I'm not, I know the number because you all keep telling me the number, but I'm certainly not in a position to start telling the state which is a better witness for this testimony and which is a duplicative witness. This is their case, and they know how much time they have. You said you'd use 1 to 2 days of, eight days? And so, the state knows what they need to do. With respect to the roles and responsibilities of producers, that's already out. Brian Carpenter and Kent Jorgensen are not going to, Kent Jorgensen's going to be talking about the safety, but he's not going to be getting into producers. And since producer is out, Mr. Carpenter's going to be left to do firearm safety. So I'm not noted. And I'm sure it's noted by the state. They're well aware of the time frame. They asked, and I said no for more time, so denied. All right, next up is state's motion in limine to prohibit double hearsay containing CAD reports.
I have the CAD report in front of me. The narrative statements that I believe are double hearsay that should not be admitted are on page 14. Everything else I think is perfectly appropriate as long as the proper foundation is laid for the hearsay exception. So my complaints are just the narrative in 14, and because it's just inadmissible hearsay, I don't see anything that's terribly prejudicial in those statements, but at the same time, they're hearsay, and they're hearsay within hearsay. So that's all I'm trying to get rid of is page 14. Thanks.
Your Honor, I'll be similarly brief. Part of what we were going to argue was that we couldn't really do a meaningful analysis since we didn't know what exactly the state was attempting to exclude. We now have that information. Based on the court's directive, we are going to be engaging in a meet and confer after this. I think that would be an appropriate time for us to review what the state has just indicated they believe is objectionable. We will determine whether or not we believe that there are exceptions, see if we can reach agreement. If not, then we can bring this before the court. This should be a very brief analysis based on the number of things they're saying they object to, and I think we can present it to the court before we get started, either tomorrow or the next day.
Yes, thank you.
Yes, Your Honor.
What is on page 14?
So, Judge, when you've seen these CADs in trial before, what it is police officers call in and they say such and such, and then it gets typed down, or a witness calls in and then it gets typed down. So that's all it is. It's one of the reasons that I want to exclude it is because some of the information is just incorrect, and I see that in CADs all the time. For example, they're talking about who's been shot. One 10-41 shot in the chest and one male shot in the stomach. He wasn't shot in the stomach. I don't know how they got that idea. But those narrative comments are frequently incorrect, and they are in this case as they are in many cases. So that's it.
All right. Well, typically this information will come in under hearsay, so we'll see how that goes.
All right.
So as long as it meets a hearsay exception, I'll let it in. You all can talk about it, okay?
All right.
Defendant Alec Baldwin's motion limine to preclude improper opinion. Oh, we already did that one. Okay. Kent Jorgensen. Defendant Alec Baldwin's motion limine to preclude improper opinion and testimony from Paul Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
I think we should go ahead and argue it because we haven't had a chance to visit about it. Go ahead.
Thank you, Judge. We've moved to exclude the testimony of Paul Jordan. Paul Jordan was not on the set in New Mexico in October of 2021. He knows nothing about what happened on the set in October of 2021. He said he read about what happened there, a little bit on the internet, heard some hearsay from some witnesses, but has absolutely no knowledge whatsoever. And so what does the state want him to testify about? They want him to testify about what happened 2 years later in Montana. They want him to say Mr. Baldwin had difficulty getting on and off a horse, and therefore apparently defies safety guidelines because a man with a hip replacement gets off a horse in such and such a way, and therefore the crew's unsafe. They want to testify that Mr. Baldwin, he wants to testify, that Mr. Baldwin had an attitude. We asked him anything else. He said, I don't think so. Mr. Baldwin had an attitude. Trying to introduce evidence from what happened in Montana, completely different circumstances, different people, different reasons for the movie, different facts, entirely distinct 2 years later, has absolutely no bearing on whether Mr. Baldwin should be convicted of involuntary manslaughter 2 years before. Thank you, Your Honor.
Having already indicated I may cut Mr. Jordan off of the witness list, I will indicate that that's not what we would call him for. None of what Mr. Nick has said really is why we would call Mr. Jordan. Mr. Jordan was the safety consultant on the continuation filming of Rust in Montana. The unions required that the continuation of the filming have safety consultants who had complete autonomy, who could not be overruled because of the obvious issue that took place in New Mexico. What Mr. Jordan indicated is that Mr. Baldwin insisted, and that was his word, that he, Mr. Baldwin, not have to follow the safety consultant's safety recommendations. Stunningly, 2 years later. And we've given the court the law that says that subsequent bad acts are admissible. This goes directly to this ongoing willful and wanton conduct. It is just additional information of willful and wanton conduct. Thank you.
You know, this is the same 404B other acts evidence that you excluded with respect to what happened before. Now they're trying to do it after. There were no live guns on the set in Montana. They were not real guns. There's no possibility of harm with what they were doing. We asked Mr. Jorgensen, what did Mr. Baldwin do? He didn't say he was unsafe with guns. He said getting on and off a horse, an attitude. Has no bearing on Mr. Baldwin's use of guns on the set in New Mexico. And the case that Ms. Morrissey's alluding to is the Rigio case that we talked about with the 404B evidence, where the individual lied about his commercial trucking license application before, and that was the predicate act for the crime, and then lied about it after, which showed that A, he committed the predicate act, and B, he was aware his physical condition didn't allow him to drive because it was dangerous. That's not even close to what they're using it for here. They're trying to show that Mr. Baldwin had an attitude and didn't comply with horse riding regulations or safety guidance and therefore was reckless with a gun 2 years before. There's no connection. It's highly prejudicial. There's no basis for admitting that evidence here, Your Honor. And certainly not from someone like Mr. Jordan as an expert.
Thank you. The court makes the following ruling. This falls under Rule 11404, prohibited character evidence. Evidence of a person's character or character trait is not admissible to prove that on a particular occasion the person acted in accordance with a character or trait. So it's not coming in. Thank you. All right. State's motion eliminate to prohibit hearsay statements allegedly made by the victim.
To try to cut to the chase here, I agree with the defense position that the statements that Ms. Hutchins is alleged to have made, and I indicated to the court that the vast majority of the witnesses do not support that she made these statements. Mr. Baldwin did not tell Corporal Hancock that she made these statements. In fact, he indicated to Corporal Hancock that it was a male who was telling him where to point the gun. Mr. Baldwin referred to that person as a he in the context of that interview. It would appear that Mr. Baldwin was referring to Mr. Souza. So it isn't until later that Mr. Baldwin begins to create this narrative that it was Ms. Hutchins who was telling him where to point the gun, and that's how she ended up getting shot. So if Mr. Baldwin takes the witness stand to testify, I believe that it comes in for the effect on the listener. I agree with them there. The other witnesses, the other two or three, I disagree. I don't believe that it has an effect on them as the listener. So these statements are highly unreliable. They are so unreliable that Mr. Baldwin himself indicated that the person who was telling him where to point the gun was Mr. Souza. So I don't want these statements that have absolutely no indicia of trustworthiness to be admitted by the two or three witnesses who seem to say that she said something. And as I indicated in the motion, those witnesses can't even agree with each other about what she said and how that could have directed Mr. Baldwin's conduct. All of them agree that Ms. Hutchins did not say, point the gun at me. There is only one witness who says that Ms. Hutchins told Mr. Baldwin to cock the gun. The other two witnesses who support that she said anything at all agree that she did not tell him to cock the gun. So I just want to get this ironed out before we find ourselves in trial. And we have all of these completely unreliable statements coming in from witnesses who don't agree. Thank you.
So, Your Honor, first I want to start with the fact that we seem to have skipped a step in the analysis with the state. The state has, you know, kind of initially, at least in their motion, jumped to whether or not Ms. Hutchins' statements would have fallen under the hearsay exception 8033. But there's another analysis that has to happen first, and that is whether or not the utterances or the words that were spoken actually even meet the definition of hearsay, period. First, it has to meet the definition of hearsay before you have to get into the analysis of whether or not there is an exception that applies. Because if it doesn't meet the definition of hearsay, the analysis ends there. It's not hearsay, so we don't have to get to the exceptions. So what we do is we look at the words that were uttered, and then we see whether or not it falls under 11801. And 11801A defines a statement, which it must be, as a person's oral assertion, written assertion, or nonverbal conduct if the person intended it as an assertion. And so what's central to that is that the words that were uttered have to have been intended and have been an assertion. And the case law is clear about what that means, and we'll get to that in just a moment. The second paragraph, paragraph B, has to do with the fact that that the declarant is the person who made the statement. And then C is where we get again into what happens with the statement. And C says, hearsay means a statement that the declarant does not make while testifying at the current trial or hearing, so it's an out-of-court statement. And two, that a party offers an evidence to prove the truth of the matter asserted in the statement. So again, central to all of the definitional pieces of 11801 is that the words that were uttered have to be intended as an assertion. And there is case law on that, which we have cited in our motion. And the case law very clearly indicates that non-assertive statements are not hearsay, and that means a statement that cannot be proven true or false. So an assertive statement would be, you know, the car was blue, the light was green. That is something that can be either true or false. It gets true if the car went through the light and the light was green. It is false if the car went through and it was actually red. Other words or utterances, like commands or directives, are not assertions and therefore not statements under the definition of hearsay. So, for example, point the gun here, or let the gate down, or don't jump in the puddle. Don't jump in the puddle is a directive or a command, and it is not true or false. It's just a statement. It's a directive, rather. And so by definition, it is not hearsay. It does not fit the definition of hearsay, so you don't even have to go into whether or not there is an exception that would apply. It doesn't fit the definition, and the analysis ends there. And so in this case, what we're talking about is the statements by Ms. Hutchins, which would have been directives. Point it this way. Show me the action. Show me the action is not a statement that can be either true or false. It's a command to do something. And so therefore, under the case law, which we've cited to the court, it's clear that that is non-assertive utterances that therefore are not hearsay. So the analysis should end there. Because the state addressed these other issues, I will address them as well, although it's not necessary for the purpose of this analysis. So the state tries to say, you know, state of mind, and I believe they just conceded to some degree that they said if Mr. Baldwin testifies, then his state of mind becomes relevant. The state misunderstands what the rule is with respect to the effect on the listener. There's no rule. Again, that's an instance where you say, okay, we're not offering it for the truth of the matter asserted, again, because there has to be an assertion, but rather for the effect that the utterances would have had on the listener. It doesn't say the effect on the declarant, it says the effect on the listener. And if Mr. Baldwin is being given directions by Ms. Hutchins, then it would explain why he did what he did, and that would be the effect on the listener. And we can look at the circumstances, the surrounding circumstances, to give us an indication that he did then rely on those statements. Now, lastly, the state also talks about that this would be potentially inadmissible because they're concerned that there's this disagreement between the witnesses as to whether or not she said anything or what she said or didn't say. The jurors, though, are the finders of fact, Your Honor. The jurors get to hear all of the testimony, and they get to make the determination about whether or not they think she said anything. If she did say something, what they think she said. That's literally their role. They are the finders of fact. And they get to make a determination as to credibility of the witnesses. And we actually have an instruction in New Mexico. There's an instruction, it's 14-5020. And that one says that, among other things, the witnesses can determine and consider the witness's ability to observe, the witness's truthfulness or untruthfulness, the witness's motivation or bias to testify a certain way, among other things. So the jurors are going to be instructed as to how to consider credibility and what weight to give the different witness testimony is going to be up to them. But I want to add that I think it's a little bit difficult for the state to argue that the admission of these statements is just unreliable, because we actually have in the statement of probable cause, which I have a copy here for the court's convenience if I may approach. And if the court will turn to the second page under the statement of probable cause, I've highlighted a sentence there, which states, and again, this is the prosecution's statement of probable cause, which was signed under oath. And we have, Baldwin was practicing drawing and pointing the weapon for the scene with guidance and instruction from Helena Hutchins and Joel Souza. That's in their own statement of probable cause. And so I think it's a bit difficult for the state to argue that there's not enough indicia of reliability or relevance or import for this to go to the jury when it made it into their statement of probable cause. And so for those reasons, we would ask that the court deny the state's motion and allow it to come in. Thank you.
Cause number D101CR2023-00039, that case is no longer pending. Because when I took this case over, I had to make a lot of changes. But one of the changes that I had to make was getting rid of the person who wrote this for his inability to fully understand the facts of the case. So here's the issue. I have a transcript of Mr. Baldwin's statement to Corporal Hancock in front of me. This is Mr. Baldwin's statement. I believe my recollection is she was there, turned a bit, like talking to him. He's saying Ms. Hutchins was talking to someone else, obviously not Mr. Baldwin, not the speaker. So I think she was hit in the right armpit, but this is all I know. And that is that I take the gun out in rehearsal where he wants it, very dramatic and very slow, trying to sneak up on them. I take the gun out, and As I take it out, it clears, the barrel clears, the hole, turn and cock the gun over here, I turn and cock the gun goes off. That's just one of his numerous statements where he indicates that it was a male who was telling him where to point the gun. So part of the problem is that, sure, the defense can come up here and say, this isn't an assertion, this is a directive. Their own client didn't say that it happened. Never at any point in time during this interview does he say that it happened. And the vast majority of the witnesses who were in the room don't say that it happened. Now, is Mr. Baldwin allowed to forget a detail, obviously a very important detail, and then testify different when he's on the witness stand to what he said to Corporal Hancock? Absolutely. But he's got to take the witness stand to do that. That's my position with the court. Thank you.
All right. The court makes the following ruling. First of all, assertions can be, or directives can be assertions. I certainly researched that. But what I'm ruling is that the statements are not being offered for the truth of the matter asserted, that the statements were said in defendant's presence and had effect upon the listener demonstrated by his actions. I have done a lot of research on the case law to make this ruling as to whether the defendant has to testify to be able to get that exception in, and I have read many cases where another person testified that the defendant was there and that he heard these words. So I'm going to let it in on that exception. And then that will obviously be an issue for the jury. Thank you. All right, next up.
I'm not totally sure where we are. Is it my motion in limiting 11?
Well, just a second. We did the clue letter. I don't know how that happened.
I don't think we did do the clue letter.
Hmm?
We didn't.
Oh, we did do. Just a minute. All right.
We have Pieta as well.
Right. Yes, okay. Thank you. D1. All right, let's do the clue letter.
So there's a letter written by, well, signed. I think Therese Davis wrote it, but I'm not 100% sure. I'm not 100% sure who wrote it, but there is a letter.
Okay, sorry. I'm fine. In my mind, I was thinking Crow, but yes, I'm ready to do the crew.
Okay, great. So I don't know exactly who wrote this letter, but I think maybe 24 or 25 of the crew members signed it. Only two of the crew members who signed it were in the church at the time of the shooting, and the letter basically says, "This was a safe movie set. Let's forget about the fact that a human being died, and another one got shot." So they get about 1/6 of the crew to sign this letter. The other 5/6 of the crew apparently declined to sign this letter. It isn't something that I recall being signed by Mr. Baldwin, and there are only, off of memory, I think, two witnesses who signed the letter who may testify in the trial. So what I don't want to get into is we've got a witness on the witness stand who's giving testimony about what they saw, what they heard, all of the relevant testimony, and then all of a sudden they get asked, and isn't it true that you and 25 others signed this letter saying that the set was safe. That obviously doesn't come in. That's hearsay all day long. And I'm looking at the defendant's response. The state's assertion fails to note that Baldwin's prior statements can be introduced by the defense to rebut a charge of recent fabrication. I don't know. I have struggled. This is in the last paragraph of the defense response. I don't really know what they mean because Baldwin, I don't think, wrote the letter and he didn't sign the letter. So I'm not sure what this letter would have to do with his prior statements to rebut a charge of recent fabrication. The defense has also indicated if a witness testifies in a manner that is inconsistent with the letter's contents, or if a witness raises the crew's position about issues raised in the letter, then the letter may be admissible. I disagree. It's a letter that is completely irrelevant. Not only is it completely irrelevant, it's absurd. For as the defense has indicated, people hardly ever get killed on movie sets. So for a person to get killed on a movie set kind of inherently means it was a pretty unsafe set. So I filed this out of an abundance of caution. I was actually kind of anticipating when I filed it that the defense would say, we agree, we're not intending to introduce the crew letter, but apparently they'd like to try to get into it somehow, and I just want the court to be aware we've got major hearsay problems here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honor, this is one of those evidentiary issues that should really wait for the context in which it comes up or not, and the reason is this. You already heard the state say, we're going to put on the medic to say, I believe the set was safe, or the camera grip to say this was a safe set or not a safe set. To the extent any witness they put up says, you know, the whole crew thought this set was unsafe, or they signed the crew letter and they get up and testify that it was an unsafe set, contrary to what they signed in the letter. We're not offering the letter to prove the set was safe. That would be the use that would not qualify under any hearsay exception, because we'd be using it to prove the truth of what's said in it. The extent it comes up and we use it, it's only to demonstrate that a witness testifies inconsistently with what they signed, or their statement that the whole crew thought this was an unsafe set is inconsistent with what other crew members said in that letter. Not for the truth, but for inconsistency, for example, for impeachment, for example. And so the circumstances in which this come up could make it inadmissible, in which case we wouldn't use it to prove the truth. Or it could be highly relevant to what the crew member who signed it is now saying on the stand, and to be denied the opportunity to confront somebody who signed that statement, for example, who says something directly contrary to it, to not be able to put that in front of them to say, well, what you're saying conflicts with what's in this document. That's not hearsay. That's admissible. It goes directly to the testimony they are given. Second point, the Baldwin statements issue. The state said in its brief, and by the way, in this brief, Baldwin's statements shouldn't be offered by the defense. Now, we have no idea what that means in the state's brief. Our point was, if we're going to offer his statements, or if they are, you have to wait and see the context in which that arises. We were just trying to preserve any right we have to argue that in one situation or another, the statements should come in or not come in. But I don't think there's a ripe issue for Your Honor to rule upon. We were just reacting to the state's one sentence in its brief, which we didn't understand. So out of an abundance of caution, we wanted to make the point that we're not waiving any rights on that. But I don't think there's a ripe issue for Your Honor to rule upon with respect to Mr. Baldwin's statements. Thank you.
I apologize. I was confused. I get it now.
So I think we're agreeing generally, absent something unforeseen, that the crew letter doesn't come in as substantive evidence. So we'll deal with any outlying issues should they arise. The defendant's statements, if offered by the defendant, are inadmissible hearsay under 11801 as the party opponent. He is not his own party opponent. So I can introduce his statements because he's my party opponent. He doesn't get to introduce his own statements because they're hearsay. So I just wanted to have some record generally that the defense doesn't get to start bringing in the defendant's statements through other witnesses. That's all it is. And I'll make my objections appropriately during trial.
That's it. We're done. Thank you. All right, the court rules as follows. The crew letter is an out-of-court statement expected to be offered for the truth of the matter asserted, and as such will be excluded based on hearsay. It could not be used as a prior and consistent statement unless the testifying witness participated in the letter and the foundation is laid. It cannot be used for impeachment otherwise, because what the witness testifies to about the conditions on the set is his or her testimony. The defendant would have to bring in a witness to state otherwise, not use this out-of-court statement to impeach the testifying witness. To do so would be an end round against the prohibition against hearsay. I think we're all in agreement. It just seems like we all said the same thing. Okay? Thank you. So that's granted today. All right, let's get back to the Crow letter. No, it wasn't the Crow letter.
It was inconsistent factual assertions.
Mayor, Your Honor?
Yes.
As Your Honor knows, we cited multiple cases in our briefs saying that the government is a party opponent. We're allowed to introduce statements that they've made if they're inconsistent. It's black letter law in a number of cases. In fact, the state's brief acknowledges that it's black letter law. Your Honor mentioned the Montoya decision. I've read that, and this is consistent with our position, Your Honor. In that case, the prosecutor said an opening statement to the jury, you are going to hear a witness testify that witness heard another person say X. The second trial, the defendant said, I want to introduce the prosecutor's statement in the opening as an inconsistent statement in this trial. And the court said, well, you're not allowed to do that because it's not an inconsistent statement. It's the prosecutor saying what the jury should expect to hear from someone say about what someone else said, double hearsay. And the court said, and this is really important, the prosecutor's opening statement to the jury was not an obvious admission of fact that might have constituted an admission of a party opponent. In other words, if it were, we'd admit it, because that's black letter law, but it's not. It's a prosecutor giving a sort of preview, not making an assertion factually, and therefore it's not a party opponent admission. It doesn't come in. Here, the statements that we are intending to use are not comments on what the jury might hear from a witness who talks about another witness's statements. These are statements that are clear, direct. Ms. Gutierrez-Reed's training of Mr. Baldwin would not have made a difference. Now they want to come in, potentially in this trial, and say, if Mr. Baldwin just did the gun training, it would have made a big difference. That is a direct inconsistency. It's not a comment about what a witness might testify about another witness's statement. The same thing is true about Ms. Morrissey's statement that Hannah Gutierrez-Reed is the autonomous decision maker, and so forth and so on. We've listed a number of these statements in the brief. These are direct factual assertions by the state in the prior case. The black letter law is that that's a party admission, party opponent admission, and therefore it comes in. The Montoya case is consistent with that, and therefore believe it supports our position that we should be able to introduce this at this trial. And that's, again, consistent with what the state told Your Honor to rely upon in Justice Thomas's concurrence. If the prosecutor wants to make those statements, that's fine, but there's a risk of undermining the prosecution's case because the second defendant has every right to present them to the fact finder as contradictions. That's from their own case, and that's exactly what we're asking the court to allow us to do here. Thank you, Your Honor. And unless you have questions about the Montoya case. Thank
you. Is this a defense or a state?
It's a defense.
Number,
I believe it was defendant's motion on limiting number five.
Number five?
I believe so.
Okay. All right. Go ahead.
Your Honor, I would respectfully submit that the defense is narrowly reading Montoya. So you have two different trials of two different defendants. So the prosecution can say X in trial of defendant one with the facts that are available and still present a different argument with the same set of facts, but as to defendant number two. And so the statements made by Ms. Morrissey during her arguments to the jury in Gutierrez applied to Gutierrez, applied to her culpability. That doesn't mean that the state should be bound or that the defense gets to introduce her statements to the jury in Gutierrez because they pertain to Gutierrez. This is a different defendant, and so the facts are slightly, they're still the same well of facts, but the facts that we're drawing upon for this defendant are slightly different than the facts on Gutierrez. And more importantly, even if the court were to find that, well, okay, statements by a prosecutor are admissions by a party opponent, the court still has to subject that decision to a Rule 403 analysis. And under Rule 403, allowing the defense to introduce the statements Ms. Morrissey made out of context, so they're picking and choosing specific statements they want to introduce, would create confusion to the jury. It would be misleading to the jury. So the statement that counsel indicated that Ms. Morrissey made about Ms. Gutierrez being the autonomous individual, that pertained to Ms. Morrissey's argument as it related to ammunition. With regard to another statement that Ms. Gutierrez was not rushed, but yet in this trial, one of the issues is the defendant rushed Ms. Gutierrez. She was not rushed
that particular day on October 21st, but rushed on other days to reload the firearm. So these would be completely taken out of context, Your Honor, and the court has the discretion to not allow these statements to be introduced as admissions by a party opponent. And I think that Montoya does apply because these are arguments by counsel that the court should exclude at a minimum under Rule 403. Thank you.
Just a couple minor points, Your Honor. The case law is not distinguishable because that was a defendant in one case and then there's a defendant in a second case. That's the only situation in which the party opponent admission rule comes up. Every single time a defendant in the second case says, I want to have the fact finder consider the contradictions that were said in the first trial, and the court said, yes, you're allowed to do that. That's a party admission. Every single one of those cases involved two different defendants. And so trying to distinguish this case by saying, well, that's who Hannah Gutierrez and this is Mr. Baldwin, there's not a single case where a party admission was allowed in this context where that wasn't the case, two different defendants. That's what the case law stands for. The element of confusion that the state is relying upon, they're saying, well, you have to balance 403. Every single case, black letter law, party opponent admission comes in, as long as it's not, you know, hearsay upon hearsay upon hearsay, where a prosecutor saying, this is what to expect, that's not an admission, it's admissible. And so these 403 balancing was in play every single one of these black letter law cases where the court said it gets admitted. And as Your Honor knows, 403 is an extraordinary remedy. So to apply 403 balancing and say it'd be too prejudicial when the black letter law says, as a matter of law, it's not because you're allowed to introduce it, there's no case to support that, Your Honor. The statement should be allowed.
Thank you. The court denies the defendant's motion. This is an issue that the court has discretion on. I'm not mandated to put it in. I have the discretion on whether to put it in. First of all, I don't think that what the prosecutor said in Hannah Gutierrez's case is relevant to a relevant fact. And even if it is a relevant fact, its probative value is substantially outweighed by unfair prejudice and confusion to the jury. In addition, I don't think the theories are inconsistent, but a continuum. Hannah Gutierrez loaded the weapon with live ammunition. Defendant Baldwin took that weapon with live ammunition. And, according to the state, failing to follow firearm safety as an actor on the set of Russ, which continued into October 21, committed involuntary manslaughter as well. So I don't see it as inconsistent theories or inconsistent fact assertions, maybe separately hanging out there in one sentence, but I'm denying the motion. All right, next up is the Pieta. Defendant Alec Baldwin's motion in limine to preclude improper opinion and testimony from Alessandro Pieta.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The state intends to offer Mr. Pieta for two general opinions, maybe many subcategories, but to sum it up, two. One, according to the state's brief, that the gun appeared to have been broken when it was in full cock position. And number two, the quality control standards that Pieta applies, the strength of the steel of the gun, and the overall condition of the gun when it left the Pieta factory. And they intend to do that because, according to their opening of the brief, to show the functionality of the gun on October 21st. But if you look at the actual trip this gun took after it left Pieta's factory, it went through a show, it went to a distributor, it went to Seth Kenny, and it went to this set. Mr. Pieta hadn't seen the gun leading up to his PTI for 7 years. He had no idea what happened to it. He had no idea if it was modified or not. He didn't inspect the gun. He didn't review the gun reports. He barely knew what happened in this case other than there was an accident with the gun. And so to allow him to testify about the circumstances under which the gun appears to be broken when he hasn't inspected the gun itself or looked at the reports or done any testing is improper testimony by someone who has not relied upon any information that an expert would need to rely upon to give that kind of opinion, first of all. Second of all, the quality of the gun when it left, the steel strength when it left, has no bearing on 7 years later or 4 years later when the accident occurred, what the condition of the gun was. The testimony that Mr. Pieta might offer on that could be wildly misconstrued by a jury, highly prejudicial, because it was hard steel and it was made with quality on December of 2017. Therefore, the gun was in perfectly working condition in 2021. There's an enormous gap there, Your Honor. And to offer that testimony from 2017, after so many things happened to that gun, as to the condition in 2021, is more prejudicial than probative. Thank you, Your Honor.
We have a made-up defense of the gun was modified, the gun wasn't functioning properly. There's not a single witness who is going to support that. Not a single witness, including the defendant himself. Yet, the defense is going to be put forth. If I don't call Mr. Pieta, we're going to find ourselves in closing arguments, and the defense is going to say to the jury, you don't know how this gun was manufactured. Maybe there was a mistake. You don't have any idea what condition it was when it left Italy. It could have left Italy in this condition, and then it made it to EMF, and then it made it to Mr. Kinney, and then it made it into poor Mr. Baldwin's hands, and it malfunctioned. That's what they're going to do. I can't let them, so I am bringing the man who owns the manufacturing company to testify. Moreover, if the court recalls from our response, this is a conversation that Mr. Nickus and I had back right around the time that I initially dismissed against Mr. Baldwin, where Mr. Nickus said, this shiny hammer, the color of the metal doesn't match the metal on the rest of the gun. We think this is a modification. So then we get Mr. Pieta to come in because we want to know, is this a modification? Mr. Pieta says, heavens no. He says, I picked out that shiny hammer because we decided that we were going to make this gun look more like a Colt so that it could be used in gun shows. That's the purpose of his testimony, and it goes directly to their defense.
I have a question.
Sure.
It says, Mr. Pieta, you've talked about the parts did not leave Italy in their current condition and will testify to what? Mr. Pieta can testify that the broken parts of the gun are Pieta parts. The parts did not leave Italy in that condition and will testify to what parts are broken. Mr. Pieta can also testify, based on his knowledge of the parts and the internal working mechanism of the gun, that the hammer, sear, and bolt appeared to be damaged when the gun was in the full cock position.
He said that during his pretrial interview.
I didn't see that.
He said it in his, I think he said it in his pretrial interview under questioning from the defense let me look for it in his transcript if you want me to. I can do a quick word search on his transcript. Under questioning, he indicated that from looking at it, he could tell that it was, because he's Italian, I don't know that he used necessarily, I think he said it was in the firing position. I don't think he used full cock, and I think that was part of the language barrier. Do you want me to see if he said it in his, I can pull it up for you.
That's all right.
Okay.
Two things, Your Honor. That's exactly the concern we have about Mr. Pieta. He hasn't inspected the gun, hasn't reviewed the gun reports. To look at a picture of a gun he saw 7 years ago and to say, I think the damage occurred this way, that is not reliable expert testimony. He hasn't inspected it. He has no idea the conditions under which it was used, the conditions of the FBI testing. He hadn't even heard the FBI tested it, didn't know what was done. And so for him to give an opinion on what caused the damage, highly unreliable, no basis whatsoever demonstrated. He has no facts about that, and it would be hugely prejudicial to admit it, number one. Number two, there's no evidence in this case that the gun left the factory broken, that it was modified with the hammer at the factory. The testimony that you heard from the Hagues, for example, about the FBI testing is whether the FBI broke it or not, whether it was modified beforehand by Seth Kenny. No one thinks that it left the Pieta factory with a hammer ground down or sideways marks on the sear. That's not at all an issue in this case. And again, since it's not at all an issue in this case, it would be prejudicial for Mr. Pieta to come in and say, we make very strong guns, we make guns that are quality guns, to give the impression to the jury that, well, this must have been a functioning gun in 2021, because in 2017, after long before many, many things happened to it, it was a strong functioning gun. That's unreliable. That's prejudicial. It's far too far away from the circumstances of 2021 to be admissible.
The court makes the following ruling. The court finds that Mr. Pieta is properly a fact witness. He's not an expert witness. He can testify to his knowledge of the gun before it left the factory. He can say it was a functioning gun if he tested it at that time. I think that you want the court to follow down the meander of strong functioning gun. He's not going to say strong. He's going to say that it was functioning, and I think that the creation or origination of that gun, for purposes of what Ms. Morrissey said, that to so that in closing, it's quelled with respect to where's, you know, in so many words, how do we know it was looking good when it got manufactured? So he comes in, but his testimony is going to end to his knowledge of when it left the factory. He can't testify. He just learned that it was broken by somebody told him the FBI broke it, and all he can say is, yeah, it's broken.
Understood. And just so that I can structure his testimony within the court's ruling, I won't have Mr. Pieta give any opinion on whether or not what position the gun was in when it was broken or anything like that. I would like to have him, if he can, because we're going to have the gun and the parts here in the courtroom, prior to his testimony, I would like to show them to him and see if he can identify, yes, these are the original parts. If he can,
if he can.
And in addition to that, part of his testimony that the gun left his plant in good working condition has to do with the quality control measures that they institute within his manufacturing plant so they don't have guns that leave that then go malfunction. So a little bit of testimony about quality control, I would ask the court for a little leeway there, but I understand the ruling. We won't have him talk about his thoughts on how the gun got damaged.
All right. Thank you. All right, is there anything else? State? Did I cover everything so that we're ready for jury selection and trial?
I believe we are. If the court wants to take a few moments to address my concern with the exhibits.
I thought you all were going to work on the exhibits.
Well, I've got some concerns based on the looks of their exhibit list that a meet and confer isn't going to resolve this issue.
We have a couple concerns of our own with some exhibits that were just disclosed yesterday.
Well, give me a copy if you want, because this will be the first time I'm seeing them. So
there is also a defense motion to compel that was fully briefed over the weekend. If the court is willing to consider that today, I think we can address it.
No, I'm not. Why are you writing documents and then not giving to me or her? What do you mean? The motion to compel? Oh, you mean the big motion to compel?
Yes, there is the motion to compel that was just finally...
You can make arguments on that, but I'm not going to rule from the bench if you want to do that. Do you want to do that?
It's their motion, sure. Ms. Johnson's responding to it.
Okay. You didn't do a notice of completion of briefing, but okay.
You did submit it, Your Honor, but I can
okay, that's
it.
Fine.
Yes. So, Your Honor, I know that this is unfortunately something that we've brought to the court on more than one occasion, and I know that this is not the time that the court would prefer to hear these issues. However, precisely because we are at the eve of trial is why we have to bring this up to the court again. As the court knows, under the laws of New Mexico, the state has an affirmative duty of production, both under the rules being 5501 and also under Brady, Giglio, and all of those. So it's been apparent from early on in the case that we were not receiving all of the productive documents and discovery that we should have been receiving. We've detailed in our motion the numerous attempts that we've made to try to address those concerns. They were not addressed at any point. And I'm going to focus on the reply that we did submit to the court because the circumstances have now changed to some degree in a fairly material way. And that is that initially we had been corresponding largely with Ms. Morrissey, who had been the prosecutor on this case for quite some time before Ms. Johnson came on. Our requests for production and our concerns about it looking like we had incomplete discovery, like it looked like we had incomplete disclosures. We're constantly met with, you have everything, there's nothing else to give you, or if you tell me specifically what you're looking for out of these, you know, IPR productions that are redacted, tell me specifically what it is that you want unredacted, and then I'll take a look. The problem with that approach, Your Honor, is that the state, again, has an affirmative duty. It's not a reactive duty. It's not that the defense has to first try to guess at where there might be additional discovery that we're entitled to, what Brady information might be out there. The state has a duty to take it upon themselves to review the documents and the discovery in their possession and to turn over anything that falls under 5501 or their other affirmative disclosure obligations under Brady, Giglio, and their progeny. So what we did was, realizing that we were getting nowhere, again, after all of these months, we had dealt with IPRA to try to take it upon ourselves, even though it's not our obligation, to try to get more documents. Those came in over the course of about 7 months, again, heavily redacted. And we could tell that there were some documents that certainly appeared to have the type of content that we would be entitled to. But many, many of them had entire sections that were just completely blacked out, so we don't know what the content was at all. We could only see, you know, who the sender and recipient were, and everything was blacked out. So we were left to guess, whereas the state has the affirmative duty of disclosure. And so what we did was then we, for the first time, I believe it was on the 27th of June, reached out, and instead of emailing both prosecutors or just Ms. Morrissey, we reached out directly to Ms. Johnson, and only to Ms. Johnson, and basically, under her obligations as a prosecutor now on this case, asked her to fulfill those obligations and do an affirmative review of everything and to turn over anything that needed to be turned over. The same day, in accordance with her responsibilities, she did then respond and said that she was requesting a full unredacted copy of the various of the thousands of documents that we received under IPRA that were still redacted, and that she would undertake an affirmative review of those items, as well as checking for an audit with the law enforcement agency. That same day, after she responded to us with the request that we had just sent her, again earlier in the same day, we started to already get disclosures, where Ms. Johnson was saying, I found documents that are subject to disclosure under Rule 5501. Contrary to what we had been told from the inception of this case, which was that we had everything that fit under 5501. It was repeatedly told to us, you have everything, you have everything. Yet we received production after production after production, totaling over 1,100 pages from Ms. Johnson over the course of June 27th to June 29th. And in each of these multiple disclosures with numerous Dropbox links, we received disclosures from Ms. Johnson where she indicated, here are documents that are subject to our obligations under Rule 5501, documents that we had never seen before, despite the fact that these documents were not just in existence with as soon as June, they had been in existence for months, over a year even sometimes. And so, and we have a number of them, Your Honor, that I will go over. And so these are the types of documents that were withheld. So we have, for example, there were documents that were created on January 23rd, 2023. They were not disclosed until June 28th, 2024. The topic of those documents, and I have them under an exhibit, which actually I believe is attached to our reply, that would be Exhibit N, is comments on whether or not it's customary for actors to be shown what was in the gun. Again, a central theory of the state's case that actors are supposed to be shown the contents of the gun so that they can check whether or not there's a live bullet or a blank or a dummy. And so those were comments with witnesses to this case, and that's Exhibit N that the court can look at. And I do have an extra copy if the court needs an additional copy. Okay, yes, Your Honor.
There's more to come in the Rust shooting trial against Alec Baldwin from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Press subscribe now.